listeners. Welcome to Talk Eastern Europe, a podcast dedicated to Central and Eastern Europe and the official podcast of the New Eastern Europe magazine. My name is Agnieszka Widłoszewska. This is episode 111, and I am joined for this episode by one of our other co-hosts, Maciek Makurski. Hello, Maciek.
Hello, Aga. Hello, listeners. How are things going?
Well, I mean, what a week last week, wasn't it? I personally think I had a bit of a news overdose.
Yeah, I'm sure that many of our listeners are following as we are the news regarding Ukraine's counteroffensive. I think it can be officially called as a counteroffensive. I still want to be very cautious here, and you know, without having a proper analysis or at least a conversation with an expert in the field, I don't want to go into the details here. But it is especially promising in the Kharkiv region, and I think as for now, and we are recording this episode on September 12th, Ukraine has liberated something around 30 villages, towns, even bigger towns. So it's really promising. I think that quite soon we will have to record an entire episode about these developments in the eastern axis of the war.
Absolutely. I have been following it quite a lot as well. And I agree with you. I would be maybe cautious as well. I think it's great what has been achieved so far, but indeed without having more information on what is actually happening on the ground and how robust these advances are and what's the situation also on the Russian side, I think it's a bit tricky to give any assessment. But I think what is quite interesting, what I've been following personally as well, is the reaction of the Russian authorities and also Russian media to this counteroffensive, because of course it's quite difficult to hide it, because there are certainly successes on Ukraine's side. It's not something that you can just ignore.
Yes, you have to somehow respond. Yeah, that's the thing.
Exactly. And so it was very interesting, because I sort of tried to follow some of those major TV shows that you always have on Russian state TV, like 60 Minutes or The Evening with Vladimir Solovyov. And on the one hand, they were a bit lucky, because one of them is not released during the weekend and the other one is not released on Fridays and Saturdays. So they actually missed sort of those hottest days in that sense. And they didn't have to react immediately, so they got a bit of time. But essentially what I see is a bit of a mix. Depending on the show, some of them will kind of address the topic. And even there is this 6 minute or 7 minute clip from another show on NTV, I think it is, that is going around the social media, where there is really an actual debate between the participants of the show, where there is not one but several people who are criticizing the Russian leadership and how this whole war has been conducted and how it's going. And it's really striking in a way, because you just never hear that. Usually, if anything, you have this one expert sort of on these different shows who is meant to be the kind of liberal one or the one that is more pro-Western or something, and then they just smash him during the...
Plus some people who wrote certain pieces, yeah, or articles or analysis, but it wasn't that popular and that accessible for the broader public. But you have those kind of voices, yes, in the debate.
Exactly. But here, at least that one discussion seemed pretty hot. But then, for example, in the most recent, so the Sunday edition of The Evening with Vladimir Solovyov, they went in the completely opposite direction. They just kept to the official line. Everything is fine. Nothing is happening. It's all good. It's all great. And then some of them are trying to use the official line from the Ministry of Defense, which is also quite funny. Ministry of Defense released at some point this statement saying that basically the troops that were located around Izium, around Balaklia, it was decided that they would regroup and they would redeploy to Donetsk instead. And it was all planned and it's all great. And it was accompanied by some deceptive actions of the troops, which I'm guessing by that they mean the sort of running away in panic and these different videos that we also saw circulating on the social media. So it is very interesting. But one thread that I would say is weaving through all these different programs is that there is an increased talk about general mobilization. So essentially, even those who criticize now, let's say, the general progress of this war or the special military operation, as they call it, even they say, well, you know, this one of the solutions would be to really go full in, right? To really do the full mobilization. And there's also these hints here and there when they start talking about, well, you know, Ukraine already has the whole of NATO behind it. Basically, all of the people are engaged and, you know, there's general mobilization on their side. So, you know, sometimes there's these like slight suggestions that maybe that means there should be general mobilization in Russia as well. So I wonder if this is a broader tactics or a broader advice from the authorities that the state media are meant to slowly introduce this idea into the minds of their audiences, that this is maybe the moment when Russia needs it.
Maybe they are slowly preparing it, yeah, or testing the ground at least, yeah, hoping that many people will react positively to this.
Exactly.
But let's see how it develops.
Yeah, because then they can see reactions to the show, right? They can see comments on the social media, etc., and that's a way for them to assess things.
Yeah, one thing I want to add, what also caught my attention yesterday on Twitter, and it was suggested that Maria Avdieva, who during the invasion became a civic journalist reporting from Kharkiv and other cities, I highly recommend to follow her on Twitter if you are there as well. And she suggested that maybe Russia has changed already a tactic or adjusted a tactic a little bit, because they had problems with energy supplies in Kharkiv and probably in other places in Ukraine. Basically, there was a blackout reported, I think, yesterday on Sunday in the city. So it might be also one way how Russia still wants to hurt Ukraine and Ukrainian citizens, yeah, which is, of course, which is, you know, we are following the counteroffensive, we are happy how it develops, but we still have to remember that it is a very harsh time for many Ukrainian citizens, not to mention soldiers.
Absolutely. And of course, the counteroffensive itself, even though it seems very successful, is paid for with the lives of Ukrainian soldiers, and it's certainly not without a cost to people's lives and health. So it's worth remembering that for sure.
Yeah. So Aga, you had a very nice time with Russian state TV.
It was fabulous, especially that these shows, some of them last 3 hours.
Yeah, they are very long, actually.
But we have to do that. I mean, I think it's very interesting to listen to everything that they say and the way they convey certain ideas.
So. Yeah, how they frame the discussion. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree with you. But maybe speaking about the discussion, let's shortly introduce what we have for our listeners today. And I think I will start by expressing our thank to our third co-host who delve into today's topic and met with our guest, who is Marie Dumoulin, a director of Wider Europe program at European Council on Foreign Relations. And they discussed something very important. They talked about an ongoing debate, if I may say that, on the potential EU-wide ban on Schengen visas for Russia's citizens. And the ban has not yet been in place, although there are several states, members of the European Union, which are strongly in favor for such a move. And their argument is mainly related to security, and they presented this idea of ban as a way to somehow limit the possibility of penetration of Russian agents of influence or even spies within the European Union. But of course, the issue is far from reaching a consensus among the EU member states. So we decided that it would be a good idea to have an episode about it. And but we of course are really aware of that it is not possible to exhaust this topic within one episode. So most likely, in one way or another, we will be coming back to this topic, perhaps presenting in more detailed way standpoints of particular member states or even politicians regarding this issue. But today I think we have a introduction to the topic.
Yes, I think it's certainly a debate that is very heated. There's a lot of arguments on both sides, and I think it is an important topic, and it can have important consequences depending on what decision is made. And perhaps just to mention that you will hear in the interview that our guest was sort of mainly arguing one side of this debate, but we of course want to bring both perspectives to the fore. So there are some articles that were published on the Eastern Europe website that discuss this topic as well and present slightly different perspectives. So we would definitely encourage you to try and read and listen to all of these perspectives and try to make up your own mind on this topic. We will of course include links to these articles in the description of the episode.
Okay, so maybe just before the interview, as a traditional reminder, I want to say that Talk Eastern Europe is proudly supported by our patrons. And if you are new around here and Talk Eastern Europe is or might be your source of information about Central and Eastern Europe, please join our community of patrons. You can do so by visiting our profile at www.patreon.com.
So hello, Marie. Thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So we are nearly 200 days into Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine. As we all know, the EU has and the West have been responding by providing significant support to Ukraine, particularly military, but also with sanctions packages on Russia. And one of the most controversial proposals has been a ban on Russian tourist visas into the European Union. So I would like to start maybe with the basics. From what you know, what you have read, what are the key arguments for this ban? What would such a ban entail? And who are the key proponents of the Russian tourist visa ban?
So the proposal originally was made by President Zelensky, but then it was taken over by a number of EU countries. And first of all, the countries that are closest to Russia and to which Russians travel in order sometimes to travel to other places in Europe, but basically because they can cross the borders to these countries with a car and then travel from there to other places. So these were Finland and Estonia, the first ones to support this idea. From what I've read, there are two main arguments to this proposal. The first one is a moral one, saying Russia is waging a war on Ukraine with a lot of atrocities, war crimes, etc. So it's morally awkward to see Russians enjoying the sun on French beaches and being tourists in European capitals.
Yeah.
So that's the first argument is really a moral one. The second one is more about politics, and it says if you want to create a pressure on the regime to change its policy, then you have to create dissatisfaction and create an awareness about the consequences of the war in the upper middle classes that are the people traveling to Europe. So these are the two arguments in favor of that visa ban. But the issue has created a lot of debate. I think we will get back to this debate with you.
Yes. And in fact, I think one of the arguments is also that about the support for the war inside Russia. Something like 77% of Russians, I think, according to a recent Levada Center poll, support their special military operation. So I do imagine that that's probably also part of the reason why some of the countries are pushing for the visa ban.
Well, this was rather an answer to one of the objections to the visa ban. Among the objections, one of them was to say collectively punishing all Russians for the war is create some moral dilemmas too. And to this argument, the answer was yes, but actually the Russian society massively supports the special operation, as they call it, at least according to opinion polls.
Mm-hmm. And has there ever been a precedent that you know of the EU or any other bloc of states banning tourist visas for a whole population?
No, they haven't.
So maybe
not
that's
that
also
I know
another.
Of.
That might be another reason why this is so divisive, or why there might be such a hesitation for such a ban.
Yes, and then it's also a technical issue, because advocates of this proposal say it's only about banning tourism, but the fact is that visas are mainly divided in two categories: short-term stays and long-term stays. Mm-hmm. So it's less or more than 90 days. And then there are several reasons for which you can come to Europe for a short stay. It can be business, it can be family travel, it can be tourism. But there is no such thing as a tourism visa. There is a visa for less than 90 days, which you can ask for by saying, I'm going as a tourist. Mm-hmm. So I'm not quite sure how a ban on tourism visas would look like.
So let's look at some of the developments, because at the end of August, we had the foreign ministers of the European Union gather to debate this specific topic. What was the outcome of that debate, and how do you assess the EU's moves so far and going forward on this issue?
So the debate led to the suspension of a visa facilitation agreement that had been existing between the EU and Russia for a number of years, and that basically allowed for cheaper and easier procedures to get a visa. So this means that from now on, from next week on, actually from the 12th of September, mm-hmm. Russians will have to pay 80 euros for a Schengen visa instead of 35. And the visa application will require more documents and take more time to be examined. But it doesn't close the door completely. It doesn't mean that there will be no more short-term visas for Russians. Mm-hmm. So this is basically what we call a compromise. There were countries saying we can't close the door to all Russians just because they are Russians and we see them as responsible for the actions of their government. And there were other countries saying we need to stop Russians coming for tourism to Europe. And a middle ground was found whereby it will become more expensive and more difficult to come to the EU. So it will also reduce the number of visas that are delivered, but we don't close the door to Russians.
Mm-hmm. Have you followed how the Russian reaction to this compromise was?
There were more reactions before, I mean, during the debate about a possible ban on visas altogether. And some prominent Russian voices had been saying, well, yes, go ahead and impose this this visa ban, it will only help us, actually. which is in some way true, because a complete visa ban, in my view, would have been a golden argument for Russian propaganda, which is mm-hmm. already arguing that that the West is driven by its essential Russophobia and that the EU countries don't like Russians as such. So closing the door on them by an active decision to impose a visa ban would have given a wonderful argument to this narrative.
Yeah. In fact, there's a good, good segue into my next question, because I do want to get your opinion into this debate, because you recently wrote an op-ed for the ECFR, where you are the director of the Wider Europe Program, that you argued against the EU-wide visa ban for Russian tourists, saying that the negative effects of the blanket visa ban would outdo the moral advantages of such a measure. So you already mentioned the Russian propaganda, but can you talk about some of the other negative effects that you are referring to?
Well, to me, it's the most important reason why we should think twice before taking such decisions, that in fact it would end up helping the Russian regime rather than creating difficulties for him. In my view, the idea that a visa ban would create a pressure by the upper middle class on the regime is wishful thinking in many ways. First of all, because the number of people affected by such a decision is not that big. I mean, less than a third of Russians have a passport to travel abroad. Among those who travel, the first destinations are Turkey, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, but EU countries are not the biggest travel destination. So if Russians can't travel to the EU, they will basically travel to other places. It will not create such a huge dissatisfaction. And above all, the urban upper middle class that are supposed to be exerting pressure on the regime are precisely the people the regime has been consistently trying to push away from any kind of political voice in the system since 2012. These are the people who went to the street back in 2011, 2012. These are the people who were supporting people like Navalny, etc. These are the people the Russian regime doesn't want to listen to. So I don't see how, even if they were affected by a visa ban, it would change Russian policy making. And I also don't see how a visa ban on Russian tourists would help Ukraine win the war. So this discussion, in my view, is creating divisions among EU countries, when actually what is most needed is their unity in the support to Ukraine and facing the economic consequences of the war, in providing military assistance, in sustaining and effectively implementing the sanctions. But yeah, barring some tens of thousands of Russians to come from to the EU will not affect the outcome of the war. It may give us some moral satisfaction, but not much more.
Yeah, I guess maybe from a symbolic purpose, it could also play a role there as well. Like you said, also this moral satisfaction. And I think also one could make the argument that those Russians who don't want to be, or who would be against the regime, have probably already, a lot of them have already left Russia.
A lot of them have left, but those who stay, if they don't have the possibility to go when they need to, they will probably end up not voicing their protest anymore. I mean, it's already very difficult to voice protest in Russia now.
Yes, yes.
If you know that you can't get out of Russia if you need to, then you basically stop to do it because... I mean, at some point you risk your life, you risk the security of your family, your relatives, etc. So you just don't do that anymore. It would put the people we owe to support, it would put them at risk in some ways. And on the symbolic dimension, there are two sides to the coin. As I said, one side is, of course, the moral symbolic part of it, saying because the Russians are majoritarily supporting the war, we don't want to have them in Europe. But this argument will be turned by the Russians, both internally, saying to the Russians, you see, Europeans don't like you. And they want to push you out. And it will also be used against the EU on the international level by presenting the EU as a club of privileged who don't want to let outsiders come to their island of prosperity. And it's already, I'm afraid, the image that the EU has in a number of third countries. So We don't True. Need to give that argument to the Russians either.
Yes. I just thinking about the kind of discussion also about those who have already left and those who are trying to oppose the regime. And I wonder if there's any debate that you are aware of about how EU states, if they're working enough with their Russian migrant populations, or is there, do you think there should be, or is there any coordination with Russian opposition groups in Europe? And could that make any difference at all?
To my knowledge, it's very different from one country to another. And I don't think there is much coordination among EU countries on what is needed there. Some countries have been very supportive of Russian liberal opposition in exile, like Latvia, Lithuania. They have bigger communities there, and they are very supportive of these people, which is of course good. Other countries have been more discreet and maybe less political in a way, but have still welcomed and helped scholars, journalists, artists who were in Russia and who were endangered if staying in Russia. They have helped these people to move out. Mm-hmm. I think Germany or France have done that in a quite discreet way, and for people who were not maybe as politicized as the liberal opposition, but still it's also important to do that. The difficult question, in my view, is how we make sure to continue supporting civil society in Russia without endangering it, because it has become difficult for civil society as such to work in Russia because of shrinking possibilities to work and express dissenting views in Russia. But it's all the more difficult to do so with the support of foreign states.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really where the future of Russia will be prepared, in my view, much more than in smaller groups of exiled people. Because in the end, if Russia has to change, the change will come from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And one of our goals should be to make sure that there remain people inside Russia who have the agenda and who have the possibility to continue their activities there.
Yeah, and which, as you mentioned, is a huge challenge in today's environment with, even just all the legal challenges for international organizations to work with local NGOs. It's, it's a huge challenge, but I also understand your point that it needs to be done from the change needs to come from the inside. Maybe I just kind of move a little bit beyond our initial conversation. I just would like to ask, talking about sanctions in general, so I'm curious on your opinion in terms of how you assess the EU's response towards Russia and beyond this visa ban discussion. Have the sanctions, do you think, there's a debate going on whether or not the sanctions are actually effective at all? And what is your take on how effective they are? And are there other sanctions or ideas in which the EU could, or policies the EU could focus on in the coming months?
In terms of sanctions, the EU has very quickly adopted massive sanctions against Russia in 7 packages, which were adopted in less than 6 months, which is quite unprecedented. But by being so quick and reaching so far with its sanctions, the EU also has created expectations in its own public that the sanctions would have effects quickly and that the EU would be able to do more and more to increase the pressure. And at some point, there is only so much you can do, because you can't sanction all economic sectors. Some of them must remain open because, medicines and so on, you can't sanction them. And basically, it takes time for sanctions to be effective. And because we have created these expectations of quick action and increasing pressure, I feel that the public doesn't have the patience to wait for the full effect of sanctions, which is starting to come. And it's already beginning to be visible in some sectors of the Russian economy, like automobile industry has been falling, the activity has been decreasing massively in the last few months. There are sectors where wages are not paid anymore because the enterprises don't have the resources to pay them. So the economic effects of the sanctions in Russia are starting to be felt. The most important sanctions which concern the energy sector, they are not in place yet. So the debate we have in Europe about, oh, we are feeling the impact of sanctions more than Russia is feeling because energy prices are rising and affecting us, it's actually a wrong debate because there are no sanctions in place at this point, and energy prices are rising for other reasons, also related to the war somehow, but not directly to sanctions. Whereas the economic effect of these sanctions, when they are put in place, will be felt heavily in Russia.
I think, of course, Vladimir Putin, who was speaking at their economic summit this week in the Far East, was quite in denial in terms of the effects of the sanctions on the Russian economy. But we will see how that goes. And you mentioned energy, and I think maybe this is kind of the final thread that I would like for our conversation. Looking at the coming months ahead, you know, many fear that this winter in Europe, not only in Ukraine, it's going to be a very difficult one. Particularly looking at the economy, a lot of European states are facing high inflation, which leads to high prices in especially important goods like consumables. And food, but also energy prices, which you mentioned. So I'm curious how ready you think Europe and Europeans are for this oncoming crisis. How serious could it get or might it get? And what impact do you think it'll have on EU policies, either as a bloc or as individual countries?
This is really a big question, and I'm afraid I don't have the answer to it because... Obviously, various EU countries will be affected differently by this. And you can already see it, that the inflation rate, for example, is very different in France than what it is in Germany or Poland. And energy prices will also be different, because the energy mix of each country is different.
Yeah.
And you have different political constellations in each country. So the first test case, in my view, will be the elections in Italy in 2 weeks from now.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, the polls are giving very good scores for a coalition which includes pro-Russian parties. I don't know what the end result of these elections will be and what government will come out of this and what will be the policy of this government and how this will affect EU discussions as a whole. Then a number of EU countries already have signaled difficulties with the sanctions in particular. And here I think of Hungary. This can also affect the capacity of the EU to continue this policy and to continue the support to Ukraine. And then, of course, growing social dissatisfaction because of inflation, rising energy prices, etc., will also create pressures domestically in a lot of EU countries, actually. I think we must bear in mind that this is precisely the calculus that Putin is making, that Western democracies and EU countries will be less resilient in their support to Ukraine than he can be in his war, because we are vulnerable to economic consequences of the war and the social tensions that this creates, whereas he can ignore them for quite some time.
Yeah.
So I would argue that in these circumstances, EU leaders have to explain to their constituencies that the price for not supporting Ukraine over the long term is much higher than the price that we are paying now. And I guess this also takes some efforts at EU solidarity to mitigate the economic and social consequences for the people who are most affected in the EU to help us collectively go through this difficult period.
Yeah. So would you say, I mean, I agree that it will be very difficult. Are you optimistic that the EU can still maintain some unity on Ukraine through the winter?
I very much hope so. I don't know whether I'm optimistic, but I think it's really needed, because otherwise the price will be much, much higher for us collectively. If we let Ukraine lose this war, then consequences will be much more far-reaching than what we're seeing now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Marie, thank you so much for joining me here on the podcast. This was a great conversation. And let's hope that we manage to stay resilient and in the face of these crises.
I very much hope so. Thank you for having me.
And that was Adam's interview with Marie Dumoulin, who is the director of the Wider Europe Programme at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you to Adam for conducting this interview. We are sorry that he's not here with us today, but unfortunately he is recovering from another bout of COVID. So all our best wishes to Adam for a speedy recovery. And I'm sure he will join us again soon. Just to mention, as we said before the interview, we will add some additional links to the description of the episode. Those are links to some articles that were recently published on the New Eastern Europe website that are also related to the discussion on the visa ban for Russians. And they present different perspectives than maybe the one that you hear in the interview, so that you have the global overview of all the different arguments and all the different perspectives.
Yeah, and before we go off, as usual, we want to ask you for help to develop Talk Eastern Europe. Our podcast is a listener-supported podcast, and we produce it in our free time. So if you like what we do, please share it with others. Give us a 5-star rating on an app. And if you want more content from us, please join our community of patrons. Depending on the level of support, different benefits are waiting for you, including, for instance, exclusive episodes, online meetings with co-hosts, and many, many more. You can also find us on Facebook. There is a special Facebook group of Talk Eastern Europe, so you can reach out us there. Also, we are available on Twitter, so if you have any idea related to the podcast, please do not hesitate to write us. And speaking about the benefits, one and foremost is our traditional patron shout out.
Indeed, and it is my pleasure this week to give a huge shout out to our patrons who support us, some of them for a very long time, and thanks to whom we can continue doing this podcast and continue delivering you some good quality content, which you hopefully enjoy. So I just want to say a big thank you and hello to David, Daniel, Carolina, Percy, RSJ, Michael, Anaïs, Tom, Olaf, CB, Klaus, Plamen, Sean, Naomi, JP, Elise, David, Urs, Ian, Sophia, Wilhelm, David, Erika, Janos, Jason, Mark, Stephanie, and Pierre. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And also thank you, Aga. It was a pleasure as always. I hope you all like this episode. Until next time, bye.
Talk to you soon.